I'm not much of a punter, not a big one, certainly. But if at the races, I do sometimes have a little go for fun. And looking through some old form books recently, I found a race at Carlisle in which I've got a clear memory of having a bet, partly because of the horse's distinctive name. There's nothing like a good name, and partly because who I was watching the race with. It's the 9th of November, 1992. The great thing about form books is you can be that precise. And indeed, it was the 1:45 at Carlisle, the Greenall's Inns Amateur Riders Handicap Hurdle, and my fancy was a 4-1 shot, Sexy Mover, ridden by Pauline Robson. Now, at Carlisle, certainly then, and I think now, you can watch the races high up on the sort of terrace roof of the stand, and you get a head-on view, a brilliant head-on view, as the horses charge uphill, up the straight, towards the finish. And I recall shouting Sexy Mover home to win pretty loudly. Come on, Sexy! Come on, Sexy! While standing next door to an ex-jump jockey, a pretty embarrassed ex-jump jockey to be perfectly precise, I think, considering the noise I was making, who'd just been telling me about his ambitions, which included, I'm sure, training good racehorses. And 27 and a half years on, his operation is one of the sexiest movers in European racing. Do you remember it, Joe Lyons?
I had no idea where you were going with that, but well done. I don't remember that.
You didn't quite hurl me off the side of the stand, but you, your then girlfriend, now wife, I think she was even more embarrassed with you. As like, go, come on, Sexy, I was shouting.
Very good.
Are you a shouter? Are you a shouter in at the end of a race, or are you a cool, calm, quiet sort of fellow?
I can be both. I lost my voice shouting for Emmett when he won the Derby. I lost my voice when Mustadier won the Ebor. I'd be shouting on my own in my own room, if you know what I mean. But in the at the races, no. I gave Even So a cheer the other day, okay. But in an empty stand, if the stands were full, I'd be quiet.
Yeah, of course, we should say these racing, obviously, races all taking place behind closed doors. So, actually, I've been remiss. I haven't introduced myself. Hello, Cornelius here, Cornelius Lysett on the Cornelius cast. And I haven't said to Jer, look, congratulations. Even So won the Irish Oaks just a few days before this recording, and Siskin won the Irish 2000 Guineas. You know, that's congratulations with a big C from somebody who's been following your career for nearly three decades.
Yeah, and much appreciated, and it's great, and I'm glad that I've grown up enough to be able to appreciate the importance of it all. It means a lot, because it took a long time getting there, Cornelius.
Well, yeah, because that day when we were definitely chatting was in November 1992. So if we'd been specific about ambitions that day, I have a feeling you hadn't long stopped being a jump jockey. And it was sort of jumpers you were thinking about training in those days, I think.
Well, I wouldn't have had much. No, I had no clue about flat racing, to be fair. I worked in America at a flat man, okay, but I was in a bad place then, Cornelius. I mean, unlike Barry Geraghty or Ruby, my career was sort of stopped for me, and it took me a good while to get over that. And the day I handed in my license, I know I went to Weatherby the next day, and they literally stopped me going into the weigh room the very next day. Think about that. I'll never forget the kick in the belly it felt like. And when it's all you ever want to do and it was taken away for you, it was horrible. And then I sort of stuttered and stammered. We got married and came home to Ireland, new country for Lynn, started a young family, started a new business. So it was... Them initial 10 years was horrendous. And when you ask me, can I remember that? There's a lot of that time I just don't want to remember, you know.
So you talk about Barry Geraghty and Ruby Walsh, who both retired, as they say, on their own terms. But your terms were injury terms, weren't they?
Yeah. Well, ultimately injury, yeah. I mean, we start, stop. I broke a leg and a lot of other things at the time, and we put the wrong pin in and rehabilitated, and then we had to go back and redo the operation and all over. And I remember lying in the back of the fence one day in Sedgefield. I think it was after riding a horse called Lassiedar for Howard Johnson, and he was a fence clear at least, and the last thing he would do is fall. Well, he just never took off, and I was lying at the back of the fence, and I had an odds on shot in a novice chase in the next race for Bill Haig, and I was lying at the back of the fence, and Bill Haig will remember this. Well, he'd confirm it if he could. And the ambulance guys came over to me and they said, "Jerry, okay? Are you okay?" And I said, "I'm okay, but get the stretcher." And she said, "What?" I said, "Get the bloody stretcher." And they carted me away anyway. And I just lay in the ambulance room. And my head was, "I just don't want to do this anymore. I just don't want to do this anymore." And poor old Bill came in. He says, "Please ride." I mean, the next horse, I can't remember what his name, but he was a certainty. And the only person he kept saying to, the only man in the weigh room that I can get is Jack Hawkins, for rest in peace. And I don't want, and Bill and Jack didn't see eye to eye. I don't want Jack. I want you to ride it. Please ride it. Are you okay? And I said, "Bill, get Jack. I'm not riding horse." And, you know, the writing was on the wall then. It was just one of those things. You know, I had stop after stop after stop. And I just thought, I had enough of this, you know. But looking back, I mean, that weigh room was full of potential good trainers. When you look back, and we mightn't have been the greatest of jockeys, but you'd Richard Fahey, you'd Johnny Quinn, you'd Clive Cox, Mickey Hammond, Carl Burke, Kevin Ryan. I'm missing lads now. And Sean Woods was in that weigh room. He was a very good trainer in Hong Kong.
So all of you riding during the, so what, with the end of the 80s, very beginning of the 90s?
Yeah, yeah. We were all in that weigh room together, yeah. Talented weigh room.
And actually, so other people still involved. I'm thinking Peter Niven, who trains, Lorcan Wire, who's a racecourse official.
Peter Niven was a top-class jockey in the sense that he rode over 1,000 winners and he was on a roll with a very big yard.
Right.
But the rest of us were trudging along, if you know what I mean.
So what they call journeymen?
Well, that's what they call us, yeah. I'll take it.
And why is it actually, you must have thought about this, because you thought about so many other things, is you were journeyman jockeys, you were soldiering, trudging on, as you put it, but you must have been picking it all up or something, picking up lots of info.
No, what it, and I'm not saying this is the reason, but the way I put it down is that we stopped early enough as jockeys to learn our trade as trainers long enough. Does that make any sense? In other words,
right,
the Rubies and the Barrys concentrated up into their 40s. And it took me 30 years to get to this point as a trainer. So they're going to be in their 70s before they get to my level, if that makes any sense.
But it is quite striking, is that the top, apart from Jonjo O'Neill, there are probably not, you know, Peter Scudamore's a trainer, I suppose, over jumps as well. But on the whole, the big name flat jockeys, and to an extent jump jockeys, haven't actually made the great trainers. Or maybe it's the other way. Maybe it's the other way around. The great trainers have been sort of more average jockeys.
Well, the most high profile top jockey is Johnny Mercer, I would say, that's making a good fist of it.
And he's training lots of winners, but he hasn't got to a level yet, has he?
Oh, well, he's only started.
Hmm.
He's only started. Look at Joseph.
Well, Duncan. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you can't, but they are doing it. You know, it takes, yeah, there you go.
So you said that you weren't in a great place at that stage, but you were still training you were training from 1994 and you were still mm-hmm. training winners. I remember, was it called Big and Bold? Won a good race?
Yeah.
Over jumps?
You come into my property now, Cornelius, you'll see on the right-hand side a lovely big mound with lovely hedge, horseshoe hedge on it, and a statue of the actual plinth statue that is down in Limerick Racecourse. That was the model that they were built on of the two Maloney brothers. So that's where Big and Bold is. And he was our one and only grade one jumps winner. And when he stopped, I stopped. I just hated it with a passion. I hated it.
Why?
The time, the injuries, the bad news. And it's amazing that back then when I stopped doing that, they told me you were mad. You couldn't break into the flat. Whereas it's the reverse now. Them guys are coming into the flat because the jumps you can't break into. Mm. It's completely done the 360. But it bored me. I mean, looking at the same horse for 6 years, telling the same stories about him, telling the same excuses about him. Oh, he's okay when he gets time. He's 5 now. Oh, he'll be grand now once we fix that leg. He'll be grand now once we give him a wind operation. He's 8 now. You know what I mean? There's just not enough hours in the day for me to do that. I mean, God almighty, it's like watching paint dry. I just fell in love with two. My first winner was a two-year-old, and I just loved the idea of two-year-olds. Buy them in the summer, break them, run by next Cheltenham, start running the next Cheltenham, bang, bang, bang. You know your fate early enough. I just love two-year-olds. Love two-year-olds. Right.
And did you slightly, because of those injuries and lying on the ground and the stretcher story you were just telling us, did you just fall? Was that the start of the fallout with jumping? And you sort of, because you'd been a jump jockey, you were bound to start if you were going to train with a bit of jumping?
If I was being honest, look, I married Lynn and her dad had a huge string of jumpers at the time. And I didn't want people saying that, oh, he's only training because his father-in-law gave him a lot of horses.
And this was Edinburgh Woolen Mills and Ashley Bank Investments.
Yeah, they're not in the game now, but they were back then with Gordon Richards and Lenny Lungo. And David had zero in. He calls my sport greyhound racing. He has zero interest in what I do. And I had zero interest in what he... So if truth be known, I sort of went that way as the stubborn person that I am. I didn't want that accusation thrown at me that I was only doing this because he had given me a lot of horses. So I said, well, I know one thing what he's not going to do. He's not going to give me a lot of two-year-olds. So we sort of parted company and I said, if I'm going to do this, it's going to be on my terms, my way, and I'll sink or succeed on my own terms. And that's just the way we did it.
And Glen Burnie, where you're now based, the first time I came there, rundown wouldn't be quite the right word, but it was pretty small, and it's a gleaming operation today. I think there were, what, half a dozen stables, something like that?
Yeah. It was what it was, and it is what it is now because we've reinvested and we've put our heart and soul into it, and this is my piece of heaven, but that's a lifetime. That's what you do.
And I remember there was a guy who came from your village to help you after school called Martin.
Right. Martin Hoare, and he's my head lad now.
And I think that's a pretty remarkable, you know, your operation has grown out of all recognition. And that guy who was a schoolboy, you know, who was probably doing his exams at the same time as coming to muck out.
He was 13.
So not even doing his exams.
No, I remember his mum coming to me, Georgina. Martin is without question the best head lad in the game, bar none. I can tell you that now. Nobody knows him. This whole place, me and him are like that. And it doesn't operate. One doesn't operate without the other. It's as simple as that. But he didn't know what a race horse was until he met me. Didn't know how to ride until he met me. And now he runs the show. But I remember his mum coming to me a few years after that. And Martin was a little bit single-minded like I was at the time. And he wasn't going back to school. Like, I could see that in him. And I remember his mum coming to me and saying, listen, what are we going to do here? Can you guarantee him a living? Can you guarantee him this? Can you guarantee him that? And I looked her in the eye and I said, Georgina, I can't guarantee what I'll be doing next year. Never mind what Martin will be doing next year. But I mean, you've got to trust us. And here we are.
And so in those early days, how much was it hand to mouth? Was it hand to mouth?
It was hand to mouth, absolutely. Like, don't get me wrong. Now, Lynn had money. You know, Lynn is from, you know, but I hadn't money. The money wasn't accessible here. Anything we did, I had to buy and sell or make things happen. And that's the way it was. And I'm that way anyway. There was no way I was going, as I said to you, this was going to either work or it wasn't going to work. And it has to be on my terms. Like, the one person I know who never thought I'd make it as a trainer is I'm married to. she understands it, but she was my biggest critic.
And Glen Burnie, you named the stables Glen Burnie after was he an eventer or show jumper?
Yeah, when we came home, we wanted a nice name, Scottish name, and they were associated with this famous eventer with the good Scottish eventer.
Ian Stark, wasn't it?
Ian Stark, thanks, Cornelius. And funny enough, the horse was bred just down the road, between me here and where I'm from, which is Clain.
Right.
He's called Glen Burnie. He was a big white horse, big grey horse. And he was called Glen Burnie. And I just love the name. And we called the place Glen Burnie. And it's now Glen Burnie State. It's Glen Burnie, right? You know, this is it. It's heaven.
And you said you came from, so you're County Meath now. You come from Clain, is County Kildare, is it?
Yeah, it's literally 25 minutes away.
But you're not, your parents aren't horsey, are they? You've got brothers and sisters. They're not horsey. Well, your brother is.
Shane followed me into the sport.
So what got you? What got you in? What hooked you?
Oh, my next door neighbour was at the time Peter McCreary, the father of Willie McCreary, the trainer.
Big Irish racing name.
Yeah, yeah. He was champion trainer. I mean, how, I don't know what the facilities had, but looking back, you know, from where we are now to there, I'm thinking how, and things have just moved on so much. But he was top, he was champion trainer in National. He was literally my next door neighbour. We grew up with the McCrearys. I'll never forget the very, like, I came down from Dublin at 7, and I'll never forget, you know, you're playing with Willie and Tom and Peter, and you're walking in around their house, and you go into, they had this colour room, and it was just wall-to-wall silks or wool or whatever, and I was just mesmerised by the colour. And that's, I remember that being the first thing. And then there's a paddock right beside our house, which they used to keep their ponies in. And I think they had a horse called, the one called Buster. I think he was called Buster. But anyway, they came out one day, and that was me. I was found riding him bareback and galloping him flat out around the paddock with no bridle or saddle. And I remember his dad, he was always that way. Peter Senior, he came out and he says, "You'll be my jockey, you'll be my jockey." He was that type of way when you were a little small lad, you know?
Yeah.
And I sort of believed him. And I just, that's all I ever wanted to do from that moment on, was I'm going to be a jockey. But my family, my own family here now, Lynn and the kids, they always say, it's okay for you. You always knew what you wanted to be. But I knew it from the age of 7 when I seen all. And then back then, like the village stopped for him. You know, he was royalty in the village. It was a little Irish village, but he was royalty in the village because he was a racing man. Racing was big then, Carnegie's.
Even bigger than now?
Now doesn't compare. Now doesn't compare. I mean, now you could have Aidan O'Brien and Willie Mullins and Gordon Elliott walk into any town in Ireland and the chances are they wouldn't be recognised.
Right. But at the time, so the McCrearys were big, you were determined to be a jockey. So when you actually became a jockey and rode your first winner, how good was that?
It took too long. How good was that? It was just too long, and then everything happened quick, and then everything fell apart quick, and then everything happened quick. My career was, that was life. I was in too much of a rush, Cornelius.
I can't believe, actually, it was only 1, 2, 3, it was only 6 seasons.
Yeah, yeah, it all happened too quick. It all happened too quick, and I was the second coming, and then you weren't, and the injuries, and that, just, yeah. I could ride. I could ride, and I looked well on a horse, and I was good, and had huge potential. But just listen, hey, go into a bar in any pub in any town, and you'll find loads of them people.
But to fall out, I'm just really struck by, you were so excited about doing it, and you ended up falling out of love with the riding side of it. Was it just knock after knock?
Yeah, I would suggest, stand corrected, but I would suggest you talk to a soccer player. I would suggest you talk to a professional golfer, and I would suggest every one of these sportsmen, professional sportsmen, would go through that. You know, you're all in. It doesn't happen, you're all out. You fall out with it. I mean, I haven't ridden a horse in, I can't remember when. The minute I stopped riding professionally, I had no interest. Lynn tried to get me into hunting. I'd rather watch paint dry. Once the buzz of riding over a fence and over a hurdle in the jockey silks was gone, I was out. I was finished.
Mm. But then you were able to go into, you know, you talked about soccer there, but you were able to go into management.
Yeah, yeah. But, and I would never have thought, and listen, it's I'm an overnight success after 30 years. It's took us that long for the penny to drop, you know. It's a huge, huge apprenticeship. And we've learned, hindsight, should I have gone in and been an assistant to somebody? Of course I should. Of course I should. But I'd have hated to have been my boss.
Well, you use the word single-minded. You have got a reputation for being single-minded. Would you have been impossible to have working for you?
I'd have been very good to have working for you. Well, I don't know that it's possible that I could work for anybody at this stage. Maybe back then I could.
But and so, because that's the other thing. You know, you've ridden horses. You've ridden horses in races. And then you start training, but you don't learn from anyone. So did you learn from a book? Did you learn by trial and error? Did you how did you learn how to do it? Is this why it's taken so long?
No, well, I'm training winners for many years now, so it hasn't taken 30 years to be train a winner.
Yeah, but to get to the Group One stage.
Well, yeah, but no. The reason you don't get to the Group One stage, I don't care who you are, unless you get the Group One horse. I don't care who you are. There's a serious amount of talented trainers out there. Never train a Group 1 winner because they won't get the Group 1 horse. It's that simple. I don't care how good you are. If you go down to the start with an inferior horse, you ain't going to win the race, whatever the race. It's as simple as that. So no, it's ultimately at the very top table with the Group 1s, it's about just access to that horse. Now, I always say it every year, I watch a race, you know, you watch the Coventry Group 2 and I look at it and I go, you start at the winner and you work down and invariably you could have bought maybe one out of the race. You know, the rest weren't accessible. They were private homebreds. Do you understand? Or way too expensive. So I always, you know, my people who help me at the sales, Roger, John, Kerry, they know every time there's a big race on telly, they're going to get a text. Of a 2-year-old race. Where was that? What did we say about him? What's our note say on that one? Do you understand? I'm like that all the time. Why didn't we buy that?
Why didn't we buy it, basically? Why haven't we got it?
Exactly. Why haven't we got that one?
Prior to this year, your reputation, apart from being plenty of winners, was doing really well with 2-year-olds. And you said your first ever winner was a 2-year-old. Do they really, you know, they're like children going to the races, going to school for the first time. Do they really get you just trying to deal with them?
Oh, absolutely. That's what floats my boat. I mean, and ultimately, they become your 3-year-old and maximum 4-year-old. I'm sort of bored at that point. But the 2 and 3-year-old is where, like at the minute, like my early career, you could only buy the speed horses. They were all the early precocious 2-year-old. And the circle has turned now. I can't get them. Now I'm having to think outside the box and I'm buying the back end 2-year-old, which becomes a lovely 3-year-old. Hmm. But when I started training, they were what everybody wanted and I couldn't buy them. Hmm. Now all the posh guys want the speed. So I'm pushed to the back of the queue for the speed. And now I'm getting all these think outside the box, Jared. Hence, I've got a load of 1.5 miles. You know, I used to get dizzy if I went past 1.2 miles. You know, a horse would have a nosebleed. But now all of our horses are that type. And it's just what we're allowed access to at the sales. If that makes any sense. But the thing is immovable. Every decade, say, it changes. But at the minute, all the money is for the speed.
But what is it about those juvenile horses, the youngest type of horse? You're in a paddock. What is it that you love about them? Is it the dreams? Is it
what? They're babies. If you met, like, if they're messed up, you've messed them up. You've got them from scratch. You've seen them as a yearling. Some progress, some don't. But it's the ultimate dream, and it's the quick turnaround. And like, I don't have an attention span, obviously, so. You know, the minute I put a rating on a horse, I'm out.
And so you stand there in a paddock looking at these 2-year-olds and thinking, oh, him, her, what can we achieve?
Oh, we all do that. We all do that. And we're obviously, none of us has cracked this code just yet because, like, we're successful, but we haven't bought that Group 1 winner.
Right.
But as I just said previously, I mean, the only Group 1 winner I bought cost me 10 grand, ended up being Gold Fun in Hong Kong.
Right. So you've got to get lucky.
There's a certain amount of luck to it. But what I'm saying to you is that them Group 1 horses are nearly inaccessible in the sales ring at a level. Do you see where I'm coming from? Like I'm not, there's no such thing as, like, you come out with loads of examples of, well, he did it or she did it or they, but they're few and far between.
So from your point of view, to clamber to that level so that you were part of that circle, if you like, was really important.
Well, the only way we could do it was consistency, hard work, dedication, put your head down. I always, always used to say, you know, the new trainer come on the block, people would be rabbit, you know, they'd go on about X, Y, and Z. And I go, talk to me in 5 years, talk to me in 5 years, talk to me in 5 years. Because it's all, I have so much admiration for the people who, it's the test of time. This game is unbelievable for the test of time. It'll try the patience of a saint. But if you think you're going to crack this, it will tear you down as quick as you can. So, I mean, at the minute, we've done what we've done. But I'm very aware, and nobody's more aware. The most obvious example is John Ox, one of the greatest trainers on planet Earth. Hmm. And look what happened to him after See the Stars.
So See the Stars is only 10 or 11 years ago, and he's been struggling to some extent.
So this game, you literally are as good as your last winner. but you cannot take your foot off the pedal.
Even you, though, when you get a year like this, when Siskin wins the Guineas, even so wins the Oaks, lots of other horses running really well. The Mister's had a lot of got a lot of fans. Even you must think. I know you're not going to say, I think I've cracked it, but you must. No. It must give you a real spring in your step.
Oh, no question. That's what I'm saying. I'm probably not getting the point across properly, but that's what I'm saying to you. After the apprenticeship I've served for 30 years doing this job, I'm able to appreciate it now. Does that make sense? You know.
No, totally.
Whereas if this sort of happened to me in my first 5, 6, 10 years, maybe I'd have thought, well, I'm great. You know, maybe I'd have been totally impossible to live with. But now I realise, you know something, this is hard. And, you know, I'm Lynn and I won't lie to you. We drove home from, we had a barbecue at my mum's house on Sunday night after racing, caught up with all the family. And I was able to turn to her and I would say to her every now and then, we've done well, Pep, we've done well. And I mean that. You know, just moments like that, because we've earned it.
And there's been a striking outpouring of pleasure on your behalf from everyone else. No one's against Aidan O'Brien and the Coolmore Ballydoyle team for one second. In fact, even so, is part of the Coolmore team. But people are pleased for you, aren't they? It's been striking, the outpouring of pleasure.
And do you know something? I hate saying the same words over and over in an interview, like appreciate, but I always thought we were disliked.
Honestly, you thought that?
Yeah.
Why?
I always thought. I don't know. I'm not the brightest of individuals, Cornelius. I always thought we were disliked, and the outpouring after that. I'm not stupid too. I understand it's whether it was me or another trainer, as long as it wasn't Aidan. And unfortunately for Aidan, he's in that position because of his success. And I just think it was more of that. But I remember on Sunday after the Oaks, Lynn and I, or Kerry and I, were sitting in the stands, an empty stand, and she just looked over me and said, did you get much text, Dad? And I said, no. Me neither, Dad. Do you think they hate us already?
Winning a second classic.
Yeah. And I just thought, isn't it a funny old game? Like, I got hundreds the first day. So by contrast, the next day was so much less. And I looked at her and I says, God almighty. And I says, it's like that, is it? And I says, well, I says, if that's what success is, bring it on.
And Siskin has been although you've had this marvellous year, Siskin's right up there, having won the Guineas, part of the Judmont empire. You've always, you obviously, when Judmont came knocking on your door, that meant a great deal to you. Because presumably, like so many of the rest of us, you've grown up with those colours and all the big names that they've been involved with.
I can honestly say that was the proudest moment of my career.
When they came knocking on the door?
Yeah. Yeah, that meant something to me, to have pros like that knock on your door. Yeah, that's an acknowledgement that nobody can take away from you.
And Siskin goes and repays. And then in 2020, when we've got restrictions, we've got the coronavirus, and he is coming to Goodwood for the Sussex Stakes. And that's a bit less straightforward than just jumping on a plane or getting in the box and coming to the UK, you know, because of all the restrictions. You had to decide whether you and Colin Keane, your jockey, would come, considering that there would be a 14-day period afterwards where you had to go into your own lockdown.
Yeah, and that irks a bit because, realistically, when we land, we could take a test, self-isolate until the test is proven positive or negative, and then get on with our lives. And why can't we do that?
But that's not the world we're living in, is it?
It's not the world we're living in, Cornelius. And do you know something? There's a lot worse off. So, and I'm just delighted that we are actually racing, because it's not that long ago we weren't racing, and none of us really knew when we were going to start back racing. So I'm not moaning about that. That's definitely not a moan, and that's a law of the land. And you know something, the powers that be have more important things on their plate than worrying about me and Colin Keane, and we'll take it.
What struck me, you were talking to the British media earlier on, is that a week or two ago, you and possibly Colin Nodd as well weren't going to come to Goodwood for the Sussex Stakes, and Frankie Dettori was on standby, etc. And what struck me, you changed your mind almost as soon as the Oaks took place at the weekend. Just explain, you explained to the British media a sort of timeline of how important you felt it was. Just try and explain that again, if you don't mind.
Well, the Oaks came and we won it, and obviously you're dragged from pillar to post, and we were brought into a press conference and we spoke to the Irish media, and we were walking out, and the manager said, "Will you come into the parade and there's an oak tree presentation?" And so we did that, and as we were walking out, I put my hands on his shoulder.
Collins.
Yeah. And I said, "Imagine me winning this without you. How would you feel if you were somewhere else watching this on telly?" And he says, "I'd be gutted." And I says, "Right, you're riding Siskin. It's all about quality. We cannot let Siskin go without you. You know, if we're going to win the Sussex, you're sticking with him. And bugger the championship and bugger everything else that comes with it. We worry about that down the road. This is a lifetime horse. And it took me 30 years to find one like him. I don't know when the next one will come through the door. I know how I'd feel if I won the Sussex without him. And I know how he'd feel if I won the Sussex and he's standing at home watching it. And you know something? It was obvious to everybody else bar us, if that makes any sense. But we were professionally thinking of every other race day thereafter at home. You know, I have entries made, I have entries to make. I could have names and horses on races, and he's my man. And then I just said, you know, we have Gary. You know, if you were injured, I'd have to use Gary.
This is Gary Carroll.
Yeah, and it's a team game, so let's do it. Simple as.
And that, you were talking earlier on about appreciating success. That is part, I suppose, of appreciating this type of heritage that racing in Ireland and Britain has. You know, the Oaks, the Guineas, the Sussex Stakes, these are races that people will talk about for decades to come.
Absolutely, Cornelius. And if when you're putting me down into the hole in the ground and the Sussex Stakes is on my little plaque, wouldn't that be fantastic? You know, they can't take that away from you. You know what I'm saying? You have, this is part of, as you said, heritage, and you have to appreciate it. And it's a tough sport. There's difficult decisions to be made, and you have to make them.
And final thought, because, and I say this to everyone every week, but honestly, we could stay and talk till midnight, as dare I say, over the years we have on the odd occasion. So Siskin goes to the Sussex Stakes on Wednesday, the second day of Glorious Goodwood, against Cameco, who won the Newmarket 2000 Guineas, against Mahatha, who was so brilliant at Ascot the other day, against Circus Maximus for Aidan O'Brien, against other horses as well. So give me two sentences on his prospects and whether he'll win.
Well, I obviously think he wins, because I go racing every day, and if I don't have a winner, if I go without thinking I can, I'm not that type of person. Every time I go racing, I think I'm going to have a winner. So he's going guns blazing. For me, he has to improve to win. I think he has improved, but he's going to be up against it. This is his sternest test, but I think he's up to it.
That was 2.5 sentences, but I'll let you off. I'll let you off. Special dispensation. Well, look, best of luck with Siskin. Best of luck in your isolation afterwards. Best of luck with the rest of the year. And those of us who have been following you for quite a long time, it's been a real pleasure seeing over the last, not just this year, over the last few years when things are going pretty well. But for Jer, the person who I was standing next to on the roof of the stand at Carlisle with Lynn, his wife, shouting "Come on, sexy!" to be winning two classics is tremendous. So congratulations again from me. Thank you for talking to us today, and thank you to you for listening to the Cornelius Cast. If you'd like to make certain you don't miss a single episode, please subscribe. And if you don't hate it too much and could manage a little review, that would go down really well as well. Anyway, speak again soon. Thanks very much indeed.